Linda Godfrey, author of the new book, Real Wolfmen, True Encounters in Modern America. The book is jam-packed with incidents and case reports from all over the country, all over the world, and some of them are pretty spooky stuff. We're going to get into some of the specific stories, then get into a discussion of the big picture. Are these really flesh and blood creatures? Are they from somewhere else? And if so, how do they get here? Where are they from? Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Linda Godfrey, your book is packed with a lot of really, truly spooky stories about these encounters from what seemed to be credible witnesses. One of the ones that jumped out at me was from Ivy Creek, Alabama. Talk to me about that.
That's a really weird one, and it's one of those that goes back to another one that goes back to the 1930s, and it involves an old school and a man who at the time was a young boy and went to school one morning, and to his shock and the shock of his other schoolmates, they saw what looked like a half of a dog man. It was the upper torso, missing the lower part of the body. And it laid there, and it was quite the exciting thing in that little town, and people came out and looked at it. And he seems to remember that it laid there for a couple of days, and then it just disappeared. And he describes it as the entire thing was covered with fairly long fur, even the face. Couldn't see any blood. It was as if the thing had been moved there for some reason. Human-like hands had claws rather than blunt fingernails. And he said the carcass lay in the yard until the middle of the next day. And I wanted to know if any newspaper people were out there and if it might have ended up in the newspaper, and didn't get anywhere that way. But the worst thing was that he was alone in his house about a quarter mile from the school with his mother and his brother when they heard a horrible scream come from the direction of the schoolhouse. And he described that sound as a cross between a wolf howling and a panther screaming. And it was just something nobody had ever heard anymore or before that. So they ran to the neighbor's house, and there they huddled with the neighbors, and everyone listened to the screams, and they seemed to come closer and closer. And it seemed to them that perhaps whatever it was that had been dead there was discovered by another one of its kind, maybe its mate, something like that. That was the impression that they had. And he never did really find out what it was. It was just sort of a long-time mystery in the area. And as I said, I've tried to contact old newspapers around there and just have had kind of a fruitless. He looked to the man who wrote me and wasn't able to find any more about it. But, yeah, that's a creepy one.
You write that it looked like it was a strange blend of canine, primate, and human.
Yeah, that from the man's description, that's how it sounded to me. And, you know, how do you explain something like that? I don't know. There's always the theory that people have that our government has long been experimenting with hybrids. But we're talking, you know, really, what, 80 years ago, when I really doubt that they had anything advanced enough. It would have to be some other outside culture coming in that would have that sort of technology in those days. And really, I think that was just his impression, you know, describing the features. I don't think it actually was a true hybrid blend of primate and canine. But it sure sounded like it from his description.
This idea of secret experiments, hybrid human hybrids with other kinds of animals, did you find any evidence that those things really are going on, that there are experiments in that regard? I mean, I wouldn't put it past them to try.
Right, right. There are experiments going on, you know, trying to graft human ear cartilage onto the back of a mouse, trying to hybridize. The successful experiments that I've heard of are taking much smaller steps. For instance, hybridizing two very closely related species of tiny fish, you know, to make a blend. And then you get what's called a chimera, which is something that actually contains DNA from two different species within its own body, two or more. I don't know how far scientists have really gotten, and I tend to suspect that more goes on in that area, especially in other countries, than we are ever privy to. But I really don't think that there are tons of, like, say, human-goat hybrids or human-dog hybrids out roaming the countryside.
Well, yeah, I kind of doubt that myself. But you think back to the island of Dr. Moreau, there's a scientist out there who sure would like to make that happen.
Exactly, yeah. I think if it's possible, there's probably someone doing it, you know. And I'm sure there are people cloning things illegally and whatever is possible to do. It's just human nature. Somebody's going to try and do it and get away with it.
Here's what occurred to me when I read your account of those remains being found. Well, number one, darn, wish somebody had kept that and we could analyze it now using
right.
modern techniques. You could solve this mystery. And number two, the idea that at least some of these creatures are flesh and blood. You get into the whole paranormal realm and the possibilities exist that this is, you know, just something we're seeing. It's illusory. It's sort of like an image that's created for our benefit, not a real flesh and blood creature. But at least those remains would suggest it is real.
Yeah, I mean, there you have a body, and it's not human, it's not any, you know, known type of animal, and I have a suspicion, you know, as he said, it just seemed to disappear. Nobody seemed to know what happened to it, and how do you know that the authorities did not take it? I think that's entirely likely, and perhaps there was no newspaper story about it, you know, perhaps it was not allowed to be talked about.
Another story you tell about is the fear on Fish Creek Road, Holly, Michigan.
Yeah, that's one of my top scary encounters because it was just totally out in the open in the dark. And this man who was very professional as a repo man, you know, taking back repossessed cars and houses and things like that, was out on this very desolate road. I've driven this road at night purposely after hearing about the story. And it's dark and it's desolate and there's, you know, it's kind of widely spaced lake houses. And he was out there looking for this truck and the property owner was gone. But there was a shed on the property that was locked. And he wanted to see if maybe the truck was in that shed. So he pulled up his truck to the window, got out, was looking in the window, trying to see what he could see. And he hears a twig snap behind him. He turns around just in time to see classic dog man, 7 feet tall, snarling and growling at him, and not very far away and advancing rapidly. He was able to somehow hightail it back into his truck. Fortunately, he wasn't very far away from the truck, and he'd left the door open. Managed to just get in, and then his first instinct was to swing the truck around and try and catch the thing in the high beam so he could get a better look at it. And by the time he did that, it had disappeared back into the woods or the shadows or whatever. And he was not about to get back out of his truck. And when he went back and tried to explain this to his employer, he was laughed at, but yet nobody else would go out there either. So it was never explained. But he said to me that when this thing growled and looked at him, he felt that It was really angry that it had been seen and that it wanted to do him some damage. You know, it was truly terrifying. And it's sort of interesting because of all the people who have observed this creature making a sound, it's never the classic, you know, owl of the werewolf that you see portrayed in movies and TV. It's always a growl of some sort. And this man demonstrated the growl for me, and I've had other people demonstrate the exact same growl. And it sounds sort of like those old cappuccino makers that would, you know, kind of the sound rises and falls. So there's this variable pitch, and it's very distinctive. It's not what you hear from a dog. Your pet doesn't growl like that. But I just find that an interesting side note. But this man was very terrified of the thing and felt very lucky to have escaped it.
You mentioned in a couple of cases, that one and then the park stalker, you call it, from Zion, Illinois, mm-hmm. that these are creatures with attitude. I mean, they seem
right.
ticked off.
Yeah, they seem to be, you know, compared to people who run into Bigfoot, people who run into the man-wolf find it a lot more aggressive or malign, if you will. It seems angry. They feel that it really doesn't like them there for some reason or another, that it wants them to keep the secret. There was... The man in Zion, you know, just felt that he was being stalked. And I hear that over and over again, too, when there's a wooded area. He had to go through a long wooded area to reach a beach in the darkness. He was taking a midnight walk and felt and heard this thing stalking him all the way through the woods. And that was pretty scary because it was dark and night and desolate, and nobody ever would have known, you know, if it had chosen to take him and drag him away somewhere. So, and it was sort of teasing him, just showing itself and then ducking back out of sight, you know, which implies a different sort of mindset. But I don't know if you want to get into this right away, but this gets into another thing that people will sometimes tell me, and they'll get done telling the whole incident, and they'll say, you know, you're going to think I'm crazy, but I felt that it was telling me. And then it'll usually be some version of, I shouldn't tell anybody, or you can't get me, not in words, but in mental impressions. And one woman who was a young married mother who was working for a doctor's office, so she had to go to work like at 5 a.m., right at dusk, and one of these things jumped up out of the ditch toward her in her car, and frightened her so much, and she felt, even though it wasn't face-to-face, there was a car window between her and the creature, that it was telling her if she told anyone where she saw it or that she saw it, it knew where she lived and it would come and get her. And she was so terrified, she didn't tell her husband for 3 days until she got up the nerve. And when I went and interviewed her in person, she was just shaking, you know, and almost in tears again just to tell it.
I was surprised by how many cases there are around military bases and involving military personnel. You have a whole chapter on that. You would think if this thing had any common sense, it would stay away from soldiers who are carrying guns and have tanks and planes and things of that sort that could hunt them down and do them some harm.
Right. Well, a lot of them are either very old, sometimes abandoned military installations that have turned into museums, or they're like artillery ranges that are out in the woods, or where there are very old military cemeteries. One involved an abandoned missile silo. So they tend to be places where military installations have been, although there was a really good sighting right north of Chicago at the Great Lakes Naval Base that was made by three guardsmen who were on duty at night. And there was a woman and two men, and they each saw it separately. And this was another case where the woman described it to me as having a head like Anubis. She referred to the old cartoon called Mummies Alive, where there was a character named after Anubis, and he had that jackal head. That was her reference to it. But that's three naval guardsmen who saw it in a very, very active and busy place. So it isn't always a deserted one. But again, I always try and look at these things from every possible side, because I think if you are keeping a reporter's hat on, if you are trying to rule out the mundane explanations, and I think there's a definite obligation to do that, you have to. And the thing about military installations is that they tend to be placed in many cases where you have a good water source and high ground so that there's good defense capability and good visibility. And these creatures do follow water, so it might be just that. But these are also the same types of sites that are chosen for holy sites. In the Bible, they talk about the high places. Churches are sometimes built on the highest elevation in a town, so that they'll be closer to heaven is the idea to that. And very often, you know, there's water near sacred places, or lakes are considered sacred. So is it that they were military places? Were they perhaps for a long time before they were a military site, a sacred place, and they're drawn to that aspect of it? Or is it just the natural features that both types of sites usually command that the animals also like?
One other story I wanted you to tell us is the swamp beast of southern Georgia. That was a good one.
Now, are you talking about the creature that the man was hunting feral hogs and looking for arrowheads?
This is June 2005. Yes, southern Georgia. Yeah.
Yeah, that one's kind of an amazing one. I've had multiple conversations with this witness, and he has a very well-respected profession. And he and some friends had leased some land in this Georgia swamp for a couple of reasons. They went out there hunting feral hogs, which have overrun, you know, much of the South and are spreading out. They're in Wisconsin now, too, and all over the place. And also, it once was a very bustling Native American community, and lots of arrowheads and things were out there. So he was actually out one day hunting arrowheads and was getting ready to go back in his truck when one of these man wolves appeared and scared him completely out of his wits. He had never seen anything like that. Ran around, got the gun, and seemed to be able to, you know, ward it off using the gun. Well, he went back another time with his cousin and a couple of the hog-hunting dogs, and the thing appeared again. And they set the dogs loose on it. It ran into the swamp, and the dogs ran into the swamp. And luckily, the dogs came back. Many times in this sort of instance, the dog does not come back. But these did, and they were winded and not wanting to go anywhere near the swamp woods again. And this man was able to find a footprint. He didn't have a camera with him, but he drew a sketch. And his profession involved some knowledge of anatomy. And it was the footprint that it left was as I had described. The upper part looked like the toe pads with the claw points, and then the heel mark that made it a little bit longer, so that it was almost the length of his size 11 shoe. And I think I have that diagram in the book.
Are you able to calculate how big some of these are just based on the size of the print? You mentioned about a print being 6 inches across.
Right.
How far it goes into the mud or something like that? Can you calculate its weight?
Well, you can get some idea. And I will say that you can't always go by the normal dimensions and structure of known canines, because one thing that witnesses do report is that they'll say, well, it didn't have hands. It had paws. But the paws look longer than a normal dog paws. So one characteristic does seem to be that the paws are enlarged or elongated. And maybe that actually makes sense. If there is a certain strain of animals that has adapted to being able to walk upright when they want to, then an enhancing feature would be to have larger, at least hind paws, so that you could balance more easily. So, I don't know if the larger paw corresponds to a bigger weight, but people will generally estimate the weight as between 150 to 250 pounds. So,
250 pounds, that's pretty darn big.
That's big for a canine, yeah. It's nothing compared to Bigfoot. I mean, the Bigfoot is, estimated at, usually 800-900 pounds. Some people who see them will say maybe 400, 500, but, they're much, much bulkier than the Dogman. And I'd also like to mention, the Dogman and the Bigfoot are different. The Dogman is not a subspecies of Bigfoot. It's definitely canine, unless you want to totally disbelieve all the careful witnesses who have seen Dogman and just say, well, they don't know what they saw. They were really seeing a big flat-footed primate, not, what they described.
How often do you see them in the same place? Or do witnesses say, I saw Dogman, and a week before somebody saw Bigfoot in the same area?
Well, that actually happens fairly often in general. They seem to like both of them places where deer are able to be hunted. So wherever deer are attracted, both of these things seem to show up. However, one thing that I really like to do when I get a report is I go to Google Earth. I go to my atlas. In some cases, you just can't beat an old-fashioned map atlas. And I try to figure out the terrain and where and map them out. And what I find is that there will be slices of territory where most of the reports are Bigfoot and all around them are Dogman or vice versa.
Linda, I'm going to have to stop you there where that music tells us we're going into a break, but it leads us to an interesting area of weirdness that seems concentrated in certain parts of the country, and we're going to get into that when we come back. Listeners of this program know that there are places in our country, in North America, around the world, where you experience a concentration of weirdness, where you have all kinds of different reports, sort of a paranormal Disneyland, if you don't mind that phrase. The Irish have a saying, they talk about places where the world is thin. And there are theories that maybe there are places that are portals, vortices, I guess you'd say, where other worlds, other realities bleed into ours. Is that a possible explanation for what's going on with these dogmen, Bigfoot, places where all of these things are seen in approximation to each other? We'll get into that topic with my guest, Linda Godfrey, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, there's a quote you use in your book. I'm looking for it, and I can't find it, but it's from John Keel, who was, of course, a wonderful investigator of all things weird and paranormal, who talks about the nature of reality. There are places, certain special places, where other realities kind of bleed into ours. Can you remember how the quote goes?
Yes, I must have been reading your mind. I have it right here. It's from time to time, the playful inhabitants of that other world climb through the curtain in the areas we call windows, and they stalk us to drink our blood and create all kinds of mischievous beliefs and misconceptions in our feeble little terrestrial minds. It's a great quote.
Windows into another reality. They can come here and at will. I don't know about at will, but occasionally they blend into our reality. Well, we can't go into theirs, so far as I know.
Well, that is the supposition, you know, and I have to say that, a lot of people have equated that with ideas in quantum physics, which I don't even pretend to understand or much less be able to explain, but that in order for current physics ideas to work, there have to be multiple dimensions, and the scientists are suggesting that perhaps they do intersect at places, and who knows whether they have other life forms or things that are able to go back and forth. You know, it's not that it's impossible anymore.
So, well, there are some areas of the world, some areas of our country, where it seems like there's this high concentration of strange stuff. Bigfoot,
yes.
Wolfman, Dogman, UFOs, where it seems like something from somewhere is coming in and out on a fairly regular basis. The Uinta Basin is one, Yakima, Washington, Dulce, New Mexico, Sedona. I don't think it's a coincidence these stories have floated around for all these years about places like that.
No, I don't either. And it really is true that I've noted where you find the Dogman, you tend to find Bigfoot. Often you're also finding large birds, or what I call the man bat, UFOs, marsh lights. They all tend to occur in the same places. Why is that? You know, it's the window area makes as much sense as anything. And I actually have discovered one sort of small microcosms of such a place that was too late to get into the book, but it's a small stretch of road in southeastern Wisconsin that I have to keep secret because that's the only way the landowners will give us permission to work there. But since October, we've had several very good and very credible sightings of Bigfoot. Another sighting of a Dogman, classic one, by just a drive-by that had no idea anything was going on there. Somebody who didn't live there just happened to find me and call me and tell me about it. Other things that are just almost too weird to even talk about, some investigators that are working with me on it have seen UFOs out there. We've had what looked like the closest thing to a traditional werewolf that I can think of that seemed to be hitchhiking along the road, and the investigators were going to pick him up, and then he turned and looked at them and actually had a muzzle. He was dressed in very tattered old clothing, but had a muzzle, but black-rimmed eyes and yellow fangs. that were not human. And he turned and sort of hissed at them, and they screamed, and later saw it being picked up by an unmarked white van. And all of this is going on in a very, very small area. We've been able to catch big footprints. This is actually where I measured those big canine prints, and we've cast those too. One day last January, happened to notice the neighbor's dog sniffing at something, found they were sniffing at what looked like big footprints, 14-inch ones, right and left, and we followed them for about a mile into this cornfield that bordered somewhere else, and then they just stopped. There was an unbroken, thin crust of snow, and we couldn't see where they had gone anywhere. It was as if, you know, a helicopter dropped a rope down and it shinnied up, or, you know, some people have suggested that perhaps there was something beaming it up, but there's really no way to explain it.
Well, it sounds awfully familiar to me. I've heard the same kinds of stories, and we've reported the same kind of stories from Utah,
right.
Same kind of thing. You know, I don't know if you heard the part of the introduction when I spoke about our initial reluctance to tell the story about these two what appeared to be men in trench coats smoking cigarettes with dog faces.
That's
pretty weird. You haven't heard anything like that anywhere else, have you?
Not in trench coats, but it did. You know, this guy was like wearing sort of tattered farm clothing and had long matted dreadlocks, like he'd never combed his hair in his life. But it did remind me of a kind of a secondhand story I heard of a family that was driving in a desert in one of the western states and saw a Jeep approaching them, and it looked like it was full of, I don't know, a dozen soldiers or something. And when it came up close and passed them, they saw that the soldiers all had dog faces.
You know, this region that you're talking about where the research is taking place, how far back does it go? How far back do the stories go?
Well, we've been closely observing it and, you know, looking for prints and making casts and things like that since October. But there are sightings that I know of going back on right on that particular spot back about 5 years, and then within probably a 10 to 20 mile range going back to the 60s.
You know, there's one of the things we have explored in our research is the Native American connection. I guess you could say everywhere in North America, there's a Native American connection at some level, but some of the places are more concentrated and a more ancient vintage. Is there a Native American connection in this area where you're looking?
There is. I've discovered that in a number of the exact sites where Bigfoot was sighted, I can find in old documents that there were Native American burial mounds that don't exist anymore. And, of course, you think of the St. Coletta's incident where the creature was digging on a burial mound, of all places. And then with the Dogman, I discovered, I go into this in my book, Hunting the American Werewolf, I discovered that I was looking at a map of places where a certain type of animal-shaped effigy mound was found in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin has something like 96% of all the animal-shaped ancient effigy mounds, that's raised mounds, in the world. And most of them are in the southern half of Wisconsin. And I realized that the places where one certain type of effigy mound were found were also the exact places where I had dogman hotspots. And I took the two maps and overlaid them, and they matched perfectly. And that was kind of a stunner. And I was able to get an interview with a tribal elder and anthropologist from the Ho-Chunk tribe, who don't usually talk about such things because they're very, very interested in figuring out what these very ancient effigy mounds mean. So that's an odd connection. And I found a very similar thing between ancient formations that are now bulldozed away but once were in Kalamazoo, around the Kalamazoo area, and that it turns out to be another dogman hotspot.
You know, there are those scientists, a few brave scientists who research Bigfoot, Sasquatch, who think it's an undiscovered primate species. One of the tough questions they face is where are the remains? If Bigfoot really is living out in the forests of the Pacific Northwest, why haven't we found any bones? Why haven't, don't we have a skeleton? I guess the same question could be raised about dog man, wolf man.
Right.
If they're real, if they're flesh and blood, we should be able to have some pieces of them or ancient remains, something of that sort. I suppose if they don't really live here in this world, they come in and out. That would be one explanation, but it's probably a tough one for most scientists to buy.
Right. That's one, you know, if you want to go that route. Now, I do think that it's different. It's a different answer for the dog man and for the Sasquatch. I mean, if you found a dead 9-foot-tall, 900-pound primate, you pretty much know you had Bigfoot. But if you found a dead dog man, you would find perhaps an abnormally large-looking dog-wolf hybrid-looking thing, maybe with elongated paws. You might notice that it seemed to have thickened muscles in the thigh and upper forelimb areas. But other than that, you would just think, well, there's a big dead hybrid dog, because they don't look human at all. You know, their features are totally canine. So, I have had people tell me that they've come across dead creatures like that. So I think that, you know, there have been bodies found of dead dog men, and people just didn't know what they were looking at. Now, with the Bigfoot, the explanation that really makes a lot of sense to me is that they're at the top of the predator chain. You know, nothing bothers them at their size. And most of the time, the question is posed, how often do you find a dead bear lying in the woods? You know, the top predators normally are not killed by other animals. They choose their time to die. They go to a secluded place. And by the time anybody could find them, well, all the normal little varmints have, you know, taken the structure of their skeleton and everything down. And that does make a lot of sense. People also have posited that the Bigfoot are intelligent enough to keep tabs on one another and drag away or carry away their own dead. So,
you know, some really interesting scientific research underway about Bigfoot, attempts to analyze hair samples. Is there anything similar to Dogman that you know of? Are there samples that have been able to be retrieved from places where people see them?
Well, I've gotten samples that have turned out to be cats, raccoons. You know, I haven't had any that have come out to be Dogman, but I suspect that if I did actually get the right sample, that it would still just come out as something like a hybrid canine, perhaps dog-wolf combination or a wolf, because, again, their physical bodies don't seem very different from timber wolves or dog hybrids.
Except they walk on 2 feet.
Except they walk on 2 feet. But that's something that any dog can do if it's motivated to. And, you know, and there are YouTube, my favorite one is this little dog that dances the merengue in some, I don't know if it's Mexico or South America, I can't remember where it was, but you can look up merengue dancing dog and find it on YouTube. It just is perfect. It's perfectly erect. It's just that in the wild, they're not motivated to do, or trained to do that.
Let's talk about a dark side or a potential dark side, and it's speculative, I know, but as I mentioned earlier, David Politis has been on this program a couple of times doing some really interesting research about people that just disappear. They're in national parks and national forests.
Yeah.
They're vanished. A couple of cases where people have come back. There was a little girl who referred to, where were you, honey? And she says, the dog took me in and ate my hat. There's other cases where there are a few remains that are found, and it looks like something, an unknown creature, had been gnawing on the bones of these poor victims. Mostly, no one is found at all. And I suppose, you know, it's not too much of a leap to wonder, at least, if you, in your book, you don't specify anybody who had been attacked and survived, but a heck of a lot of people don't come back at all.
Well, yeah, you know, I always jokingly say, to my knowledge, no one has been killed or hurt unless they were ones that, you know, never lived to tell about it. And so I suppose that could be, but they don't seem that interested in attacking humans, you know, really. And when I've talked to Native American elders about it, one thing that I hear over and over is that not only were the Bigfoot and the Dogman here before the first people, there's some ancient business between them and humans that forbids them from eating humans. And that's, although, You can also find a number of Native American culture stories or legends about cannibalistic, so-called cannibalistic, because they're talking about eating humans, not eating other Bigfoot, Bigfoot that would eat humans. So there actually are both traditions found among Native Americans.
Well, you mentioned it in the book a couple of times about how far back the connection between Wolfman, Dogman, and humans seem to go. You even have stories about Wolfman as protectors of humans. And I remember Romulus and Remus, that's actual wolves, I guess, that raised them. But talk about that for a minute or two.
Yeah, there always is that aspect. And I don't know if it comes from our association with dogs as protectors. But there was even one tale back in Middle Ages of Europe, when wolves were considered terrible. There was still the story of the werewolves of Livonia, who were considered protectors of the crops and who would descend into hell every fall to fight the demons there for control of the crops and to assure that they'd have a good harvest. There are also Native American legends of wolves being helpers and protectors. There are Native Americans that sort of like those Chinese that we talked about earlier, consider themselves descended from wolves and members of what they call the wolf clan.
Is this a solvable mystery? I mean, is there some piece of evidence that could sort of, aha, that's it, now we understand it? Or do you think it might be just something that's out there to mess with us, to challenge our concept of reality, make us think?
Well, I'll tell you, the longer I'm in this, the more I start tending to lean toward what you just described, because just when I think I've got something pinned down and I think, yeah, these are natural animals, you know, I've got this explanation, some other thing crops up that just makes me lean the other way. Weirdness always comes into it, weirdness and strangeness. Just like, for instance, that area where we were, you know, surveying the Bigfoot, and at first we were getting prints and thinking, yeah, these are natural animals. We can see where they come to drink. We can see their whole ecological pattern here and what they're doing. And then we follow the tracks that just end and disappear. And then we start finding giant wolf prints. And then we start seeing UFOs. So, you know, what starts out as seeming realistic and mundane seems to turn into this panorama of the strange.
Well, I'm familiar with that. I mean, you recall the story about the bulletproof wolf that got shot,
yes,
5 or 6 times and didn't really even flinch, and then it walked into a field and its tracks go out into the mud, and then poof, they just stop and it's gone. There was another wolf story that we recalled about a giant wolf whose back came up to the top of this car. It was traveling with a dog, a great big dog, but whose head was even larger than its body. It looked like it was just somebody had taken a Rottweiler head and stuck it on a German Shepherd.
Yeah, see, I mean, that's just, you know, it's so hard to get your head around those things, but the witnesses are sober and credible, and oftentimes the investigators start encountering those very same things.
Have you?
yeah, it's kind of strange. If anybody's reading my blog at lindagodfrey.com, I'm telling about an encounter I had in one of the kettles, which are very steep bowl-shaped depressions left by the glacier that are around southeastern Wisconsin. And I live kind of near the Kettle Moraine southern unit of the state forest. And so it's easy for me to hike around there. And a few weeks ago, I was taking just my usual hike in an area I often went to just walking. I wasn't on any sort of expedition. And I happened to see some branches that were bent in a way that I know are supposed to mean that Bigfoot did it. And just for fun, I picked up a stick and I started making wood knocks, which is something I just don't normally do. Lo and behold, I got an answer. And the answers started turning into hearing a very large animal scuffling through the dry leaves on the bottom of the kettle. And then the next thing I know, there's a thunder. I'm making it a little short, but there's a thunderous crack of wood, and I'm looking at a 35-foot-long, we measured it later, and it was longer than I said in my blog, 35-foot-long live oak branch, 9 inches in diameter, being cracked. First it was twisted and pointed directly at me, And this tree was standing on the bottom of the kettle, so the branch was at my eye level. And something from behind the tree that I couldn't see was pushing it toward me and then ripped it from the tree.
Oh, boy.
It fell 30 feet to the bottom of the kettle.
Linda, we have to continue that part of the conversation on the other side of this break. I'm going to have to start hanging out with you. That sounds like some interesting and fun stuff.